I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hi, and welcome to A's Plus, the San Francisco Chronicles podcast on the Oakland A's and Major League Baseball. I'm your host, A's beat writer Matt Kawahara, and today I'm joined by the Chronicles national baseball writer, John Shea. We're taking a look back at the A's season, why they fell short down the stretch, some bright spots from this year, and what the offseason might hold for Billy Beane and company.
Well, hi, John. Thanks a lot for taking out the time and joining us today. We're going to talk a little bit about the A's season and just kind of break down what happened there, kind of coming down the stretch. You were on the call on Monday, the end of season call with Billy Beane and David Forst and Bob Melvin, where everybody sort of reflected on the year. And I think one of the most striking things for me, and I'll ask you to maybe your thoughts on this too, but was when Billy was asked basically, is this core player core going to be coming back? Are they going to be keeping sort of the foundational guys into next season? Because they do have a group of young foundational players who are still under team control, at least for next year, and a couple of guys who are even under control for the year after that, But his answer was very just uncertain as to whether, you know, what they're going to do with sort of this player core. And he cited payroll as a factor and not really knowing yet what their payroll capacity next year is going to be. But beyond that, he also made a point to just say they're going to need to sit down and sort of discuss what the direction of the team is. And I think that was a change because obviously from year to year, there are always sort of payroll questions about what the A's are going to be able to do there. But the last couple of years, I think it's been pretty pretty clear that they were at least going into the offseason with a young foundation of guys that they knew were going to be able to sort of build around and kind of craft the team around. Whereas this year, they're going into this offseason and they still have those foundational guys, but they don't maybe necessarily know who's going to be there next spring and what they're going to be building around this year. I don't know if you got that same sense, but that was one of the things that stood out to me.
I exactly got that same sense. That was the first thing I thought about when he said that. He says, oh my gosh, are we going to be approaching an off season in which the A's are sellers? And I immediately reflected to a couple of off seasons in the past. I mean, you remember when Hudson and Mulder were traded within days of each other, I believe it was after the 04 season. And then, which really in retrospect didn't harm them right away because they were in the ALCS in 06, 2 years later. But then they really fumbled. Bob Guerin took over and they were pretty awful for 4.5 years. And then Bob Melvin took over and brought them back to, more glory than the Guerin years for sure. And then the other years, I think it was after 14 when Donaldson was traded to Toronto. Mm-hmm. And those were both huge and significant trades that you thought would just make the team go away. 04-14, it's kind of a 10-year itch sort of thing, and we're not to 24 yet, but we are at 21, soon to be 22, so maybe it'll come sooner. And I mean, when you look at this roster, what are the three most tradable pieces that could help build a farm system that is not very good? And the reason maybe Billy Beane is saying that is because the farm system needs depth it doesn't have. I mean, who did they call up in the final weeks to help them? Really nobody, except guys they kept recycling in and out. There wasn't a stud pitcher, a stud hitter who came up and helped them at the end when they needed somebody the most. And, given the farm system is not deep and maybe some of the high round picks haven't or didn't pan out, it's the old Bill Walsh mentality: better to trade a year early than a year too late. And immediately I'm thinking about the two corner infielders, Matt Chapman, Matt Olson, and maybe Sean Manaea as guys they could trade right now and get something for. I mean, you know, Manaea's, you know, up there in service time, as in Chapman and Olsen, not going to be a free agent right away, but, you know, like Bill Walsh would do, he would trade, you know, too early, you know, as opposed to losing them in free agency for little. Now you could maybe rebuild or start to rebuild the farm system. And those are three big names. I think the A's could contend next year with the team, or for sure contend with the team as is, because I don't think they're losing. I mean, obviously they're losing the free agents they picked up at the trade deadline, Marte especially, the best player on the planet, it seemed, during his time in Oakland. Otherwise, you know, Canna is the big name, Lowry, Moreland, but, you know, a couple of relievers who are up there in age. But you're looking at Olsen and Chapman, who could really bring in some, you know, big time prospects. And yeah, they could contend next year, but what happens after that? A year or two or three down, if Olsen and Chapman are not re-signed, and they won't be because they don't re-sign their own free agents to big money deals. They all go elsewhere. You know, Liam Hendricks, Marcus Semien are both in the playoffs as we speak. Actually, Toronto didn't make it, but almost did there, and the White Sox did. But yeah, I could see something like that. It kind of reminded me of how the A's do business. They trade some big stars for prospects, and they really didn't get much for Hudson. For Mulder, they got Dan Heron, a young Dan Heron, who was very good for a number of years. The Donaldson trade wasn't all that good either. So, you know, they made some wonderful trades over the years, obviously, especially, you know, during the deadlines for many of these seasons. But that might be an intent. That might be a conversation they're having. And it's unfortunate for A's fans. It's more here we go again. And with the stadium not resolved, and who knows if it'll ever be resolved, the next step is to rebuild. So it wouldn't be the first time, and A's fans are used to it.
Yeah, and that was another thing that stood out from that call was Bean was asked, you know, how does the uncertainty about the stadium situation play into the possibility of extending a long-term contract offer, a significant extension offer to young stars? And he basically said, we can't do that until he said that it's probably not something we're going to do, is extend a significant long-term extension offer to a young player without some sort of stability as to what the stadium situation is. And so that obviously that goes right to the situations with Olsen and Chapman, and those two guys they're going into their second offseason of arbitration eligibility. You mentioned Manaea, who I believe is going into his last year. Chris Bassett is going into his third year. Frankie Montas, who had a really strong season, especially in the second half, is going into his second year. Ramon Laureano will be a first offseason of eligibility, even though he's under suspension right now. So that could maybe affect some of the negotiations there. But, you know, but Olsen and Chapman, basically, you look at the year that Olsen had, he's going to be in line for a significant increase. It kind of remains to be seen where he'll place in the MVP voting, but just kind of all around the growth that he made this year as a hitter, not only with the power numbers, which were pretty striking, especially against lefties, but just as all around hitters, and coming off of the down year that he had last year in the shortened season, I think he finished, you know, top five in the league in OPS, and he was top 10 in most major categories, slugging and on base percentage, runs scored, RBIs, home runs. It was just a really impressive all around year. And yeah, you look at, you know, what his potential value would be, and then teams that would covet something like that. I think it's pretty obvious that would be attractive if they decided to go that route. Chapman would be an interesting thing, an interesting, you know, consideration for me, just coming off of his year, because I think it was pretty clear that throughout the entire season, he was still coming back from the hip surgery that he had last year. And, you know, he came into spring and was talking about how he felt really good considering how he wasn't really that far removed from it. And obviously he played throughout the season and he played just about every game. His defense was still pretty strong, but I think he cited a couple of times over the course of the year, just how in talking to other guys and actually just in talking to other players who sort of observed him, they were really impressed just how he handled that comeback process because, you know, some guys who have that sort of hip labrum repair talk about how it takes a year to really feel like you're back to yourself. And he had that procedure last September. So, you know, we're 13 months removed now. And he played the entire season, basically kind of coming back off of that. And he still hit something like, I think it was 27 home runs, but obviously you saw the strikeout numbers spike. You saw the average dip. And I think, you know, I guess evaluating him, you would have to maybe weigh how much that matters, comparable to the defense that he plays at third base and everything like that. So I think he would be a pretty sort of interesting commodity, if you will, just to see, you know, what the value there would be. But obviously there's just sort of a lot of questions about whether the A's will entertain those sort of offers or whether they do want to go into next year and see if they can kind of keep this foundational group together, at least to maybe try to make one more run, or like you said, I think that was an interesting point about whether it's, you know, erring on a year or two early is the better move.
Chapman is so fabulous defensively, and we saw him, you know, have bigger years offensively, and the hip is an issue for any ball player. I mean, look at Buster Posey, you know, several years really before he came back strong, now at 35, but he's more of a play twice every series kind of guy instead of playing every day, which sort of prolonged strengthened him, kept him strong over the course of the 6 months. But he's 34 and Chapman's closer to 28 and able to play 150 plus games, like you said. But and they don't have to trade him. Obviously they could keep him for another year, let his numbers get rebuilt, let him get healthy and healthier and stronger so that he can maybe rebound offensively. But I think, you know, I think the bottom line, the common denominator is John Fisher, the owner. It was obvious that it wasn't Billy Bean and David Forrest who didn't want to bring Marcus Semien back. I mean, come on. The offer that they gave him was ridiculous. It's because John Fisher didn't want to bring him back at $18 million for one season, which would have been the qualifying offer. And that's exactly what Toronto gave. And what did he do? Well, he continued to be a wonderful team guy, hit the most home runs ever for a second baseman, moved from shortstop to second. I mean, he's the Bay Area kid. If you were going to keep anybody, it was going to be Marcus Semien. And if they don't keep him, that's basically the precursor to trading Chapman and trading Olson, and certainly not offering him either one an extension. And like you said, Billy Bean said as much. No extensions, no stadium, no extensions. Well, they're not getting a stadium anytime soon. We all know that. And they could probably break ground at the Coliseum tomorrow. I mean, we could go into this, in different ways, heavy or light, but the fact is the A's picked a whole lot, picked the option that was a lot more complex than just staying home at the Coliseum. And it's an option that no other A's owner in their history had, because that was never an option because the Warriors were there and the Raiders were there. Well, those two teams are gone. And they have the property themselves. You wipe out the arena, you wipe out the Coliseum, and you build, you know, your dream neighborhood and your bars and your hotels and all that stuff, and the crown jewel ballpark. Well, that's not so easy. Let's try down here with all these other obstacles, because we want to wait another 5 years before anything happens. Meanwhile, let's party in Las Vegas. And I mean, the story is just so nonsensical. Insane what this team and the fans suffer more than anybody. the players are, it's kind of the you start your career in Oakland and then make the big money somewhere else. And the manager in the front office, both awesome, but the ownership is just keeping the team down, basically. It's not pushing it up. And that's a bummer with attendance and with the, you know, no improvements at the Coliseum. And they've basically given up on season ticket holders. But, hey, these are all old stories. The new story is the offseason and what they're going to do. But I don't see John Fisher being interested at all in bringing back any of these guys because it'll mean a bigger payroll, and he's not going to be into that.
Yeah, it is tough to see, I guess, to gauge what's gonna happen from that perspective. I think from the team's perspective, Bob Melvin, the last day of the season before the last game, he voiced the desire to for the team to bring back the core, and he said that if they do retain that sort of young foundation the foundation of players anyways that they have under control, he does feel like they can be a contender next year. And Chris Bassett said the same thing. I talked to him a couple of days before the season ended, and he said, yeah, I hope they bring us back. He doesn't know it's not his decision, but he also thinks that if they were to return the guys that they have coming back, they can contend next year. And that one of the funny things about this season is something that Melvin noted in the end of season press thing was that they haven't had very many years like this where they went in thinking that they were going to be a contender. They were a contender for most of the season, and then they didn't make it at the end. His point was he didn't remember a year like this since he's been in Oakland where he felt like it was a playoff caliber team and they didn't make it, because the teams that his team, the teams in Melvin's tenure that did not make the postseason, they were not good teams. I mean, the four teams before this, if you count, it was three full seasons and then the one season that he came in halfway through before this that didn't make the playoffs, they all finished like something like 20 games out of first place. So those were all teams where they weren't necessarily going in, you know, trying to contend. And this year was different. And there was, because of that, I think the prevailing thought and the prevailing feeling toward the end there was just disappointment that they couldn't get it done. And it was an unfamiliar feeling for them because obviously the last 3 years they've made the playoffs, and all the guys who are in that core, that's all they know, is that feeling of getting to the end and at least going on to play a wild card game.
The A's have always been known for finishing strong. I mean, even going back to the early 2000s, yeah, some of those teams struggled in the first half and just went bonkers in the second half. And that's what they needed in September out of this team. But from September 1st, the A's were 13-17. And they lost Liriano, Bassett got hurt, and what a gamer that guy is to come back at the end like he did. I think most would have just taken a pass and say, hey, I don't want a repeat. And his answer to that was, well, if there's a repeat, I know what doctor to go to. I mean, come on. what a gamer. But, hey, I was kidding you in the press box at the end of the last homestand. They had six to go, and they were three games back. And remember that year in 2012 when they had six to go, and they were four back, and they won the division over Texas, beating them three in a row at the end. Different circumstances, obviously. This was a wild card, so a whole bunch of teams were in front of them. But with six to go, they were three back. But they lost five of their last six, and they lost, I think, 28 or 48 games to the Mariners this year, whatever that was. They just couldn't beat those guys, and that was the difference maker. And that's what helped Seattle stay in contention till the final day. They beat up on Oakland all that time. But they didn't get that last run, and that was the unusual thing for this team. It's too bad, because I would have loved to see Marte and these other newcomers in the postseason. But, you know, when you look at this roster, the bullpen just ruins so many games. And you look around the league and you have all these fireballers, you know, throwing 97, coming out inning after inning. And the A's trotted out Romo and Petit, you know, throwing in the 80s. And at an advanced age. And it's just, how did this happen? Why do they have to rely on these guys? Where's the farm system? Where are the young guys coming up who can throw 97? And that's got to be the emphasis, you know, getting, I mean, the A's were at the cutting edge of analytics, and now it seems like they've fallen behind a bit, getting these fireballers out of the bullpen. And remember how much Bob Melvin used to platoon a few years back. And now they have so many set players hitting both righties and lefties. Is that a good thing in this day and age? I don't know. But it seems like they sort of have to figure this out, a real important offseason on a whole bunch of fronts.
We'll be right back with more on A's Plus after this. And remember, you can access all of our A's coverage and more with a subscription to the San Francisco Chronicle. Go to sfchronicle.com/pod. That's sfchronicle.com/pod.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
One thing that I do want to go back to is the second half. I think they went something like 18-27 over the last 45 games. And there were a lot of, I think it was difficult to sort of diagnose exactly what went into that and whether there was one or two things that sort of flipped them. But obviously losing Laureano, that was something that initially they seemed like they were able to sort of weather. And obviously he's an interesting and an important part of that team, not only because of the way that he plays, but I think because his demeanor is a little bit, I don't know if unique is the right word, but you remember in the playoffs last year, there was a game, I want to say it was the one game that they won against Houston in the playoff series that they played last year, where afterward it came out that he had basically lit into the team in the dugout saying that in mid game, saying, I don't want to go home and let's get this together. And maybe that's something that they needed down the stretch this year, or that was missing for them was just kind of the guy who had that sort of, who was able to deliver that sort of message. I'm not sure necessarily if that was the case, but that could have been one thing that they were missing. And then both Billy Beane and Chris Bassitt himself pointed to Chris Bassitt's injury as, I think the term Billy's was an inflection point for them in the season, just because not only did they end up, you know, losing for 5 weeks a guy who was building a candidacy for Cy Young contention, and was the ace of their staff and the workhorse of a rotation that led the majors in innings, but teammates were talking about how they just, his presence in, even when he's not pitching, in the dugout is so important because of the feedback that he gives to the guys who are on the mound, the other starters who are pitching, and sort of just his voice and his presence in the dugout is key for them. In addition to just the way that he was able to take the ball and be so consistent every 5 days. But so they missed that a lot. And Frankie Montas, obviously he sort of stepped up in Bassitt's absence, but without sort of that steady ace who was, you know, he was pitching six or seven innings basically every time he took the ball, the rotations wasn't carrying as much of a workload. And I don't know if that necessarily exposed the bullpen a little bit more, but immediately after, like a few days after Bassitt's injury, was the first of that series of bullpen breakdowns. You know, that it started with the Giants series where they lost that 6-5 game, I think it was August 21st, the Giants, where they had like a 4-2 lead, I think a 5-2 lead late in the game and weren't able to hold it. And then it was just a series of breakdowns where it seemed like the same thing was happening every time, where they trotted out guys and nobody could hold the lead. And to your point, yeah, they didn't have a lot of hard throwers. And so those guys have to be so fine and so pinpoint when they are brought in. And I think it was, you know, it becomes a little bit more incumbent on the manager to sort of mix and match and make sure that the matchups are so sort of finely tuned for those guys to be successful, where you can't just kind of throw out a guy who's throwing 99 and be like, all right, if you miss, maybe you get a bad swing or you get some weak contact. Those guys were, if they miss, you're seeing games like the Toronto game where they lost 11 to 10 and they were up 8-2 in the eighth inning or something like that. So yeah, I think that there were a lot of things, and it just seemed like that it all sort of snowballed down toward the end. And by the time, you know, they did get hit by some injuries like late in maybe the last week or 10 days. But I think by that time, it seemed like, you know, the odds were definitely stacked against them there. So there was a lot that sort of factored into to just not being able to make that sort of second half run, like you said, that they've become so accustomed to doing.
So you're talking about Bassett being a leader and everything, but when you're on the injured list, it's harder to lead. It's harder to get in someone's face and yell at them, get them going. And who's that guy on the position player side? Is it Chapman? But with his numbers down, you know, what's his impact? And I maybe you answer that, but also answer. And you had a great interview with Mark Hanna. You know, it was a pretty sentimental thing when he got the walk-off hit in the final home game. I mean, here's a kid who came out of San Jose, Bellarmine, went to Cal, came back in the Rule 5 situation and trade, and he's really been a force. He's really adjusted a lot. I mean, Simeon left, he became the leadoff guy, and I'm not sure if he's that type of team leader, but he would be a huge loss. A guy who can play different positions, first base, throughout the outfield, and turned into a very good center fielder, very athletic ball player. He's got pop, he's got great on base, and now it doesn't look like he'll be back. I mean, he's going to man what Simeon's going to come in with Simeon's year in Toronto, but he's probably going to command more than the A's are willing to pay. And it was kind of a sentimental interview you had with him, right?
Yeah. To your first question, I think Laureano is that guy for them on the position player side who's, you know, sort of the fiery guy, and he'll, I do think Chapman sort of emerged as a team leader. He took on a lot of leadership aspects, and maybe that's happened over a couple of seasons. But I think this year in particular, he really really kind of embraced that role. And I don't, but there, I think just, you know, naturally they have different demeanors, and obviously you can lead with different demeanors. I mean, Marcus Semien wasn't a get in your face and yell at you kind of guy. He was just a rock solid guy who was in the lineup every day and just worked to get better every day. And I think a lot of players sort of drew something from that. And I think, you know, so there are definitely different ways to lead. So I don't necessarily know that it's like the A's were absent, like there was any sort of leadership void there, but I was just with the Laureano example, I just wondered if maybe not having him around and not sort of having his demeanor there, maybe if there was something missing there, just because I don't know that they necessarily have a lot of other guys who have that same demeanor. As for Canna, he's going to be a free agent. And, you know, while he did sort of express that he would love to be back with the A's, I think he's realistic about the possibility that the definite possibility that won't happen, just because, you know, if they do decide to go in with sort of this, maybe remaking the roster or not trying to, you know, you saw what they did with most of their free agents last year. And he is a guy who is coming off, you know, he had a really strong first half, and then he was on the injury, like he had a hip issue. And he actually, when he came back, he explained that he was having issues with both hips. And so he, you know, whether it was related or not, his production sort of dipped in the second half, and they did move him down from the leadoff spot into more of a middle order role. And he started to hit for a little bit more power in the middle order role. So he does have that versatility of being able to, you know, be a leadoff guy and work the count and see a lot of pitches from the pitcher and work walks. And obviously he's amazing at getting hit by pitches. Who knows how that happens? Or he can hit down a little bit lower and maybe try to hit for more power and be more of a run producer. And defensively, it seems like he is pretty good. He covers a fair amount of ground out there, whether it's in the corner outfielder spots or center field. So I think, you know, if he does hit the free agent market, I think he would be an attractive player for some teams and probably, like you said, probably won't command the same sort of Marcus Semien deal and probably won't command the Starling Marte deal, which we're going to have to see how that, what he ends up getting. I think that'll be a fun one to watch.
Yeah, that will be a fun one. I mean, is he going to go to a major market team at his advanced age? I mean, he was spectacular.
What's he, 30, so fun to watch. 32? Is he 32?
Yeah, 32, yeah. And yeah, but I mean, he could do it all, really, 5'2 guy. I mean, he's turning 33 this week. Hmm. So you're gonna sign a 33-year-old for 3 years and, you know, 20 million plus. Yeah, I mean, because he could beat you in so many ways: the speed, the outfield defense, the throwing arm, the pop. He crushes balls, and it's just so fun to watch. He might not have the home run totals he did a few years ago with Pittsburgh, but my goodness, he's a 300 hitter. He's going to have close to a 400 on base, you know, approaching 900 OPS, and just so fun to watch. He makes everybody else better too.
47 steals. And also the defensive aspect. I mean, I think he leads the majors in outfield assists since the start of the 2015 season, to the point where nobody runs on him. I mean, we saw that like over the 2 months that he played with Oakland, like there were very, very few times that teams like ran on him. And there was one, it was a game in Anaheim where he threw out a runner going, I think it was first to third on a single. And afterward, Chapman, who caught the ball and placed the tag, he was like, yeah, I realized afterward, I had never seen somebody test him. Like I'd never seen somebody run on it. And he figured that that's just how much respect Marte's arm carries now, is the teams just don't run on him. Like, if there's any question, they don't. So yeah, he's just all around, I think, impressed a lot. There were several people who made the point that they knew he was a good player before the A's made the trade, but they just didn't realize how good until they saw him every day. And yeah, he has played for mostly smaller or mid-market teams. I mean, Pittsburgh, Marlins, you know, spent time with the A's. And so, yeah, it will be interesting to see if maybe a bigger market takes a chance on him. And I just seeing from some of the reports from Miami before the trade deadline, I think it was the Miami Herald had reported that the Marlins were extending something like a 3 years for $30 million offer, and Marte's camp wanted something more like 3 years and $50 million. So, I mean, with the second half that he put together, I would have to think that there are teams that would be, you know, interested or willing to at least, you know, could negotiate up to that point.
Yeah, for sure. 3 years, 60 or 3 years, 70. No sweat for some of these teams that you stick them out in center field or anywhere out there and hit them 2, 3, 4, 5. And
he was durable too. I mean, yeah, he missed a couple of games at the end of the year. But beyond that, I mean, he started basically every game for them other than one game that he missed after he got hit in the head by a pitch. And so, yeah, he's durable for sure.
Big void next year. We already know he's not coming back.
That would be a shocker. I think that that would be a big surprise. But yeah, it does leave the question of, you know, if he's not coming back, they're not going to have Laureano for the first month of the season, at least because of the suspension. I think he's still going to have something like 28 games on the suspension to serve. So they'll have to figure out an option there for center field. Assuming that, you know, Canna's not back, they'll have to maybe fill in a corner outfielder there too. And I think it will kind of bring to the forefront something that you mentioned earlier, which was what is their depth? Like when they were coming down the stretch and the bullpen was having those problems, they weren't able to sort of dip into their, the AAA pitching staff and bring up guys who could come up and be effective, like lights out relievers for them. And they had a pretty good record of durability for the position player side until sort of the end where Andrews and Lowry got hurt and Mitch Moreland was kind of in and out for a lot of the season. But they were able to kind of, you know, Seth Brown came up and spent most of the year with them and hit 20 home runs. And his average was, you know, low, but he was able to at least provide a little bit of power sort of as a bench or platoon guy. And I think he's a guy who next season could maybe take on maybe a bigger role because he plays some corner outfield. But yeah, that's going to be a question, is just how they fill these holes that at least, you know, for now, going into the offseason, it looks like they will have, regardless of what they decide to do with the roster.
So you're saying Sky Bolt is not the savior?
Sky Bolt, he was up for a fair amount of, I think, for the final month. And we didn't see very much of him. And Luis Barrera, another guy that they brought up for just really short stints and just didn't get a lot of playing time. And I'm sure, you know, part of that was because of the guys that they had. They were trying to, you know, make some sort of last ditch run behind. But we just didn't, you know, see very much from them in the small sort of windows of opportunity that they got. So it'll be something to watch. One thing that I want to hit before just we wrap up here was the Billy Bean question, because that was another sort of major question for him in that end of season thing, was because of the speculation and the reports that the New York Mets, who have their vacancy for president of baseball operations, and he's one of the three guys, or now I guess maybe two guys left with Theo Epstein not interested on their short list for that. Whether it's something that could be in play for him. And I would have to say that his answer when he was asked both if he wanted to respond to those and if the Mets had reached out to him was pretty inconclusive. I don't know if that's the right word. Vague. I don't know what would you say you drew from just sort of the way that he answered those questions?
Yeah, it was a little surprising that Theo and Cohen, the Mets owner, didn't see eye to eye on any future. I mean, that's like the last frontier for Theo, who ended a drought in Boston, ended a drought in Chicago. And now, I mean, he's already going to the Hall of Fame after doing that, right? And now he's working with Major League Baseball. And the Mets could have used somebody like that, right? But if not, there's Billy Bean and Sandy Alderson, who was, extended for the purpose of kind of overseeing the transition with the baseball operations people. Obviously brought in Billy after his playing days in 89-90. And then when Steve Schott came in, Billy was promoted to general manager, and then a role Sandy had. Then Sandy shortly thereafter went to the commissioner's office. But Billy brought Sandy back, right, in an advisory role a few years ago before Alderson went to the Mets. So there's a real close relationship. And it was kind of funny that Billy in the conference call was talking about normally when you do these things, the team has to go through the owner and then the owner gives his permission or it doesn't give his permission. But, you know, with Sandy and Billy, I mean, they talk so often. I mean, I'm sure they've already talked about this, and Sandy gauged Billy's interest. Billy seemed to be out the door to the Red Sox back in the early 2000s, but stayed. He seemed to be out the door in the past year or two with his soccer ventures, but stayed. So it's not just the players and the roster core, but it's the front office core that is going to get a lot of pub coming forward, because the manager, after next year, he'll be a free agent, right? And talk about a hot commodity with Melvin. And David Force, too. He's turned down a lot of offers to stay in Oakland. And if Billy does go, maybe David would take over the lead role. And then if Bob leaves, he'll hire, you know, a new manager, new staff. So we could, in the next year or two at the latest, this is going to be a completely different setup in Oakland.
A lot of questions going into the offseason, but definitely a lot to keep an eye on. Well, John, thank you very much for taking out the time today and for talking through some A stuff. And we'll see how the offseason plays out.
Yeah, we'll monitor it, and you'll be all over it. Thanks a lot, Maddie.
Thanks to John Shea for joining me today on A's Plus. And thanks to all of you for following along with our A's coverage all season. Our producers today were G. Allen Johnson and King Kaufman. Thanks for listening.